hppodcraft.com.
The call from England came while John was in the bathroom. Laura answered it. He came into the bedroom a few minutes later. She was still speaking, but he could tell from the expression in her eyes that she was anxious.
That was a few lines from the short story Don't Look Now by Daphne du Maurier. Not to be confused with Look Now, the long story by Daphne Don't Maurier. That's happening in Opposite World. Here, we are continuing to cover Don't Look Now on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
Me, I'm Chris Lackey. We are not here at hppodcraft.com and Patreon and your heart.
We are in your heart.
Me say hearts.
By the way, Bizarro World du Maurier, Daphne Don't Maurier, she was very short-lived because when it came to figuring out what the opposite of the birds would be, can't do it. What is it? Fish? The fish? The land-based mammals? There's no opposite. So
true. You
know, she's no Darl's chickens. My favorite of opposite writers. No Expectations, such a great book.
No Expectations.
No Expectations. Wonderful.
Secret to a Happy Life.
That's right. He also wrote that book, Oliver Straight, I love. A truthful account of two rural towns. All right. Who was that reader we heard at the top?
That was the talented Barbara Ford, luring us into a sense of safety. Mm-hmm. But let me tell you, the story does not end with safety.
Don't be fooled by our reader.
She's a great lady, but she's selling you a bill of goods right now.
And why don't we recap what's happened so far?
Oh, yeah. Okay, great.
In this story, last week we talked about it. A couple from England, they're vacationing in Venice. This is John and Laura. Although they seem to be enjoying themselves, we learned pretty quickly that they've recently lost a young daughter, I believe, to meningitis. Her name is Christine. Yeah. They're at a restaurant, and they run into these old ladies who are twins, one of whom is blind. And these women tell Christine that the blind woman has seen her daughter sitting with John and Laura. This blind woman's apparently psychic. She can see dead people. Mm. And Laura receives this news. She's shocked, but she's pretty happy about it because it seems that Christine is happy, her ghost hanging out with them. John, of course, is very suspicious. The ladies actually say that John also has a psychic gift, even though he might not know it. Now, while John and Laura are wandering around Venice, he sees what he thinks is a small girl in a pixie hood, jumping across some boats and running away from a situation. He's just heard some violent screaming from nearby. He thinks it might be associated with that. They run into the old ladies again, and the women say Christine is warning them to get out of Venice. Their daughter is saying, you gotta leave. And the blind woman can hear her saying that. Something bad is going to happen. They gotta go. When John and Laura get back to their hotel, they find out that their son, who's in boarding school back in England, is under watch for appendicitis. So that must be what the news was. The bad thing that they need to leave Venice for. They start trying to figure out how to get home soon, and the next morning the school calls again. They say Johnny had a restless night, the surgeon may have to operate, but he doesn't want to unless it's absolutely necessary. They've taken x-rays, and the appendix is in a tricky position. It's not awfully straightforward, so they want to get back to England ASAP, and that's where we left them.
There is a lot here about logistics and getting back to England, since they actually drove to Venice from the UK.
Yeah, they have their car. I'm a little ignorant of that kind of thing. So I know that now you can take like the Channel Tunnel, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
With your car, and they put it on a train car or something like that, and then it goes over. But at the time, that's a fairly recent thing, isn't it? In the 70s, how did you drive to the continent?
Ferries.
I was like, how did they do this? I want to know in the 70s how you did this. I just don't understand it.
I don't remember when the tunnel was built, but you can take cars via ferries. I mean, people still take ferries a lot of the time.
Yeah, yeah.
There are some trains. I don't know when they existed, but I've seen them in my son's train books where the train would go onto a boat.
Oh, I see.
And then it would go, and then they would dock, and then the train would go off the boat onto a set of tracks.
That stuff is so super cool. I don't know why I'm so interested in it. I got to look this stuff up. All right.
You got to talk to my son Albert about it. He'll tell you all you want to know.
He'll give me all the information.
Laura is going to fly back, and he's going to get a train that can have a car put on it so that he can go fast, I guess. But he won't leave until the next day. The plane, however, is leaving right away. So he suggests that maybe he go with her on the plane. And she says, you're being foolish. You know, we've got to get the car. What about all of our stuff? We can't just leave these things. And he's like, yeah, you're right. One of us there will be fine.
Also, when you take a car trip, you always bring way too much stuff. It's like, when you have to take a flight, you're conditioned to, okay, I'm just going to take my carry-on or whatever. But every time we throw stuff in the car, I mean, we'll have boxes of magazines back there, things we're never going to look at. But you just feel so, I've got room. I could take stuff with me.
Yeah.
Now, John was willing to wait a little bit. He says, no need for panic stations. Surely 24 hours wouldn't make all that difference. Laura says, it mightn't to you, but it does to me. I've lost one child. I'm not going to lose another.
Oof.
Can't really argue with that. So no. He says, yeah, okay, you go. I'll just follow up the next day.
So he sees her off onto a water taxi. He's now alone. He goes back to the hotel room, and it feels very melancholy and lonely because he is alone. John sits and has lunch on his own, again, because he is alone.
One of my favorite, I was watching Kung Fu Theater one day with George Eckhart, and one of the guys says, "Don't you feel lonely living alone?" And I don't know why, it was the funniest line I've ever heard.
Oh, Kung Fu Theater. Those were the days.
Yeah, I love that.
He thinks about Laura and the fact that she must be airborne by now, that she's, you know, flying to the UK.
She's in the air now, and he's seeing new people show up for the starts of their vacations. And that is such a crappy feeling.
Yeah.
When your vacation's over and you're getting your stuff and you're checking out and new people are showing up, they've got a whole week ahead of them.
Yeah.
You're so jealous. Ah, I got to go back home and to work and look at these folks.
Jerks.
I relate to it is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I do too. So John grabs his things and he heads down to the water taxi to wherever his car is parked because there are no roads in Venice.
Right.
He gets on the ferry and it heads out.
The ferry churned its way up the Grand Canal. So many impressions to seize and hold. Familiar loved facades, balconies, windows, water lapping the cellar steps of decaying palaces.
Another ferry was heading downstream to pass them, filled with passengers. And for a brief, foolish moment, he wished he could change places. Be among the happy tourists bound for Venice and all that he had left behind him. Then he saw her, Laura, in her scarlet coat. The twin sisters by her side, the active sister with her hand on Laura's arm, talking earnestly. And Laura herself, her hair blowing in the wind, gesticulating, on her face a look of distress. He stared, astounded, too astonished to shout, to wave. And anyway, they would never have heard or seen him, for his own ferry had already passed and was heading in the opposite direction.
What the heck? What's she doing back in town?
Come on, she should be on that plane.
She should be in the air right now. And he thinks there must have been a holdup with the charter flight and it had never taken off. But in that case, why had Laura not telephoned him at the hotel?
Yeah.
And what were those damn sisters doing? Had she run into them at the airport? Was it coincidence? And why did she look so anxious? He could think of no explanation.
First, he calls back to the hotel trying to explain that his wife might return since she didn't get on the flight.
He says, tell her to wait. If she shows up, I will be back ASAP. At this point, he's just kind of annoyed because he's gotten this far in his trip. Now he's got to go all the way back.
Yeah.
Me, I would already be going straight to the kidnapping schemes. You know, why the heck is she there? Why is she with those women?
Right.
He's also worried that he is worried that maybe the sisters are just working their way into their lives even more. It says, one thing was certain. He would not allow Laura and himself to be saddled with the sisters and become involved with their affairs. He could imagine Laura saying that they had also missed a flight and could they have a lift to Milan? I like as he's going through this crisis, Du Maurier keeps up that atmosphere of people enjoying themselves, though he's in crisis. It says there were more people than ever, the afternoon crowds walking shoulder to shoulder, every one of them on pleasure bent. That is such a particular feeling, you know, when you're going through hell with something private. And all around you, people are enjoying themselves or even just doing trivial things, shopping. Where do you want to eat?
Yeah.
And you're like, my wife might be kidnapped right now. I can't believe all these other people are out having fun.
So John gets to the hotel to see if his wife has returned, but she hasn't. The hotel clerk suggests that maybe she went to the other lady's hotel, but he doesn't know where they were staying. In fact, he doesn't even know what these twins' names are. John calls the airport and finds out that the flight left fully booked. He's very confused as to why she would change her mind.
The manager shrugged. You know how these ladies can be, sir, he said. Which I assume means just erratic and senseless. Is that what he's trying to say?
You know, ladies can be.
They don't think. They just run around, smack into walls, turn around, go the other way. I can't think things through.
Oh, my God.
They don't do things for reasons.
How was that supposed to help him
as
well? You know, ladies, they're crazy.
This is Italy. You can find another one. There's probably another confused lady out there. Just pick that one up.
Oh, God.
None of them know where they're going.
Oh, boy. So the hotel manager asks if he was sure that it was his wife that he saw. And he says, you know, I'm positive. I swear it. It was her coat. It couldn't have been anybody else. I would swear it in a court of law. So John and the hotel manager call the Torcello and ask if they knew the names of the twin old ladies, but they don't. So he wonders if the ladies told her that the plane would crash, and then maybe that's why she didn't leave. So John decides that he can't wait around, and he's going to hit the streets to see if he can find his wife or the twins. So he goes to the restaurant they were at last night, and he asks if they know, because remember, they saw the twins at that restaurant. But they also don't know the names of the ladies. Now John is worried. Maybe they kidnapped Laura. Right. Maybe they have some plan to do her ill will. He decides to go to the police.
Yeah, I think in the film, there was this extra scene that's not in here where Laura went to see the sisters at their home, at their apartment.
Yeah.
And the blind woman has this sort of fit,
yeah,
which was a very strange, because she wasn't actually prophesizing anything. She just starts freaking out and touching herself, kind of.
Yeah.
So it got the sexual ecstasy to it.
Mm-hmm.
Very strange. After this happens in the movie, after his wife is suddenly, he's seen her and he's trying to figure out what's going on, he tries to find the court where that apartment was and he can't do it.
Yeah.
Am I remembering that right?
Yep, that's right.
It's a total Music of Eric Zahn moment. Do these women even exist?
Yeah.
Is this a place that I actually went to? And I thought that was a really cool improvement on the story in that one moment.
Like, he was kind of weirded out. He was there at night and he was yelling, trying to find them. And then these other people started coming out of their homes.
Right.
They're like, who are you? You know, he's like, English. Does anybody? And nobody spoke English. And he was going to ask them.
Oh, that's right. And they think he's a peeping Tom or something, right?
Yes. So he runs out of there. They start like screaming at him. And so it's really bizarre and unsettling. The whole,
yeah, that scene is really good.
So while waiting to talk to the police, an older couple are there also waiting. This man's wife, his purse has been snatched. And they ask him, you know, why he's there. And he lies and he says he had a suitcase that was stolen. They say that the city is going downhill, especially with the murderer at large. And then John is like, murderer?
And I was like, murderer?
Yeah. So it says, a grisly business. One woman found with her throat slit last week, a tourist too, and some old chap discovered with the same sort of knife wound this morning. They seem to think it must have been a maniac because there doesn't seem to be any motive.
The whole plot with the murderer, in the film as well as in this story, it seems like it's a whole separate story or novel that just happens to be happening in Venice at the same time.
Yeah.
And we don't get to hear that story. It just collides with this one once or twice.
The feeling I got when I was watching the movie was that all that stuff was just to create atmosphere and a mood.
Sure. Well, that's the thing. It's funny how we try to find patterns, even as readers. I'm thinking they wouldn't, unless he's actually committing these murders somehow and he doesn't realize it.
Yeah, I was thinking that too. That thought crossed my mind that he was going into some kind of weird trance and he was the one that was actually killing people.
Yeah, it just seemed like it should tie a little more intimately up with the story, but, and I guess we're spoiling things, but it doesn't really. It's sort of a red herring and then drives toward a pretty tragic event. But
yeah,
it's not what, it just seemed odd, like this whole other thing was going on that wasn't, like I say, intimately woven up with their story. So it's a
yeah,
interesting way to structure the story.
Yeah. So a police officer calls the man and his wife in. John's like, oh, maybe I shouldn't do this. Maybe I'm jumping the gun. And he's ready to leave. And then the couple come out. They're all angry because the police didn't help. And the policeman says, okay, come on, you're next. And so he's like, okay, I guess I'm going to go talk to the police.
And because that other couple was angry, I just kind of assumed that these would be your very typical horror story, unhelpful policeman.
Yeah.
And so John goes in there. He says, then the questions, the sweat beginning to appear on his forehead, he launched into his interminable story. The first encounter with the sisters, the meeting at the restaurant, Laura's state of suggestibility because of the death of their child, the telegram about Johnny, the decision to take the chartered flight, her departure, her sudden inexplicable return. When he had finished, he felt as exhausted as if he'd driven 300 miles nonstop after a severe bout of flu. And I've certainly had that feeling after I've had a talk for a long time. But the way that they go through that list of everything that he told them also made me feel like they're not listening to him.
Yeah.
This is just going to be a lot of work for nothing.
But that's not the case.
Yeah, that's not the case. This is an interesting twist.
The investigator asks about Laura's mental health and John voices his concern. And the investigator asks if they argued. And he says, no, we didn't have any kind of argument.
He looks for some practical solutions to this at first. And when those don't appear, he says, it could well be that your wife had a sudden attack of amnesia. And meeting the two ladies served as a link. And so she clung to them for support, which is pretty out there.
That's a stretch.
Yeah. It says, you have described the ladies with great accuracy, and I think they should not be too difficult to trace. So I felt like that was a brush off, especially because that was such a silly theory.
Yeah.
Yeah, she just must have had a sudden attack of amnesia. I'm like, these police are busy with a murderer. They're not going to help out.
So they tell him to go back to the hotel and then they will investigate. John says he knows the police have their hands full with the murderer, maybe subconsciously trying to connect his wife as a possible victim.
Yeah.
He goes back to the hotel and has them send up a double whiskey to his room and a ginger ale. So he's going to just relax. He's going to chill a bit.
He's going to try. There's a song that comes on the radio and reminds him of his wife. It's just a crappy situation, having no idea where she's at.
So he puts a call in through to England to check on his son. John finds out that the operation was a complete success and Johnny's recovering nicely. He's relieved. And then the woman from school says something strange to him. She goes, "Oh, we're all so relieved. Now I'll get off the line and you can speak to your wife." What?
Yeah.
It's his wife. She gets on the phone. She talks about her travel and about the school. But this whole time, he's in disbelief. He knows he saw her in Venice just like hours ago. And then he has to explain to her that he's not actually in Milan with the car, but he's still in Venice.
She's a little upset about this. It just doesn't make any sense why he'd still be there. And she hears him slurring a little bit from the whiskey. So she thinks, did you just get drunk? But he fesses up.
Yeah, he tells her that he thought that he saw her with the twins. She thinks that he's being crazy and tells him that he should leave tomorrow, and he agrees.
She goes, "You knew I'd gone to the airport. Really, darling, you are an idiot."
So harsh.
Jeez, he was worried about you. But he's glad she's safe. It says his sense of relief, enormous, overwhelming, was somehow tempered with a curious feeling of unreality, almost as though the voice speaking from England had not been Laura's after all, but a fake, and she was still in Venice, hidden in some furtive pension with the two sisters.
Now, John sits there. He doesn't understand what's going on. He knows what he saw, and he thinks that he might possibly be losing his mind.
Sure.
He goes down to tell the manager that his wife is fine, but then he kind of feels embarrassed about his mistake, so he just kind of leaves and goes out for dinner.
Yeah. After all the freaking out, I'd be a bit embarrassed as well. But, you know, if you were to really see something like that, because I've been on the street or out with my wife before and turned and saw somebody for a minute from behind, thought maybe it was her, but you figured out pretty quick.
Yeah.
Like if I'd seen her, you know your significant other, you know, if I'd seen her, I would know I'd seen her. It's not possible that it could be somebody else.
Yes.
So it's just got to be such a difficult thing for him to wrestle with.
So after dinner, he calms a bit and he finds some courage. He goes back to the hotel. When he does, there's a police officer there. John tells the manager that he has found his wife. The manager is ecstatic. And the manager says he figured that she was found because the police officer there told him that the two ladies had been arrested.
Right. It says the manager was obviously apologizing on John's behalf to the policeman, who looked annoyed and gave tongue to this effect, his voice increasing in volume to the manager's concern.
John apologizes profusely, saying that he will go to the police station and personally apologize to the women. The policeman agrees to take him. It seems that these little old ladies were very upset by the whole thing.
Of course they were. He wondered if there was some penalty for giving the police misleading information involving a third party. His error began, in retrospect, to take on criminal proportion. Like I said, I thought everybody would just ignore him. It's amazing to me that the police are totally competent in this story.
Yeah.
You know, that never happens. He didn't even give them names for the old ladies. They figured it out. They tracked them down. They brought them into custody.
Yeah.
They were really following through with the stuff he told them.
Yeah.
Talk about opposite world. That never happens in these stories.
No. That's another thing. I've been reading the Spider-Man comic books to my son, Albert, the old ones.
Yeah.
And the police in there are always really awesome.
Oh, yeah?
They're really competent. And I think it was that, you know, I think Stan Lee and the gang like police.
Yeah, right.
You know, because they help people out. So they never, at least in Spider-Man, they never put them in a bad light. They're always, you know, Spider-Man's happy when they show up. They managed to take care of a bunch of criminals. So this reminded me of Spider-Man.
Interesting. You know, though, I always kind of related to the police in those comic books if they are mad about working with a costume vigilante.
Of course.
Because it's like this person doesn't have to obey any of the rules that I have. There's no dash cam on the Batmobile. If I was working for the police and they were like, here's our strategy, we're going to go up on the ceiling and shine a light into the sky, and then a guy dressed like a bat's going to come help us out, I would quit that day.
Yep.
Anyhow.
So John goes with the policeman to the police station. The women are there, obviously irritated and worried. John hesitates before he goes up and explains and apologizes profusely.
This other investigator that he's talking to doesn't speak English so well. He says, he points to the document. They wrote down everything that he said when he was in there earlier. And he points to it and he says, this document all lies? You not speak of the truth? That was the first like colloquial writing. In here.
Not speak of the truth.
You're not speak of the truth. Aye.
The policemen are upset with him for making these claims, but John says it was all a misunderstanding.
Why? Why you lie?
The police ask the women if they want to press charges, but they are nice old ladies and they see it was all a mistake and that John is deeply embarrassed by it all. An officer is going to take them home, but John insists on walking with them and explaining what happened exactly. Once outside, the blind sister turns to John and says, you saw us, and your wife too, but not today. You saw us in the future. Now, he's confused by this. The non-blind sister tells her to stop talking about it, She doesn't want her to go into one of her trances in the middle of the street.
Well, they did not have that line in the movie.
No.
To tip what actually that vision was all about. It's left in the movie for us to figure out.
Yeah.
That it was indeed him seeing the future. It's hard because I saw the movie first, but did you have an inkling that that might be it when you saw the film?
Yeah, when they dropped the bomb that he might be psychic earlier in the film, yeah, I did. They didn't need to spell it out like they did in the story.
No, I didn't think they needed to either. And it's also, there are two things in here that seem like they might be the result of his psychic ability. This is clearly the right one, and then the other one turns out to be an error, right? So it's kind of cool the way that they play with that ability.
So he tells them everything, and they are very sympathetic. They get to the hotel, and the ladies ask him to come up for some coffee, but he declines. He apologizes again. She says something here I thought was interesting. There is nothing to forgive. It is one of the many examples of second sight that my sister and I have experienced time and time again, and I should very much like to record it for our files, if you will permit it. Her files?
Yeah.
So, like, is she some kind of paranormal investigator?
That's what it suggests. Yeah, we could return to these ladies and have a whole series of paranormal adventures in Venice. Or she's just keeping a file of incidents when men get embarrassed. It has nothing to do with magic or psychic abilities at all.
Oh, yeah, it could be Blind Sister and C. That's the name of the show, Blind Sister and C.
And see?
Because she can see.
Oh.
See. Yeah, because she can see. The one's blind and the other one can see. So she's CE. You might want to call it Blind and Sight Sister, which is probably a better name. But I like it.
Well, that's a great name. Yeah.
I like the more confusing version of it, which is...
You should test all of these. I'm sure that...
Blind Sister and CE. That's going to move DVDs, I think.
I think it's going to move a lot of DVDs because that's what people are buying these days. I would actually, you know, when this movie was had some interesting international titles... Don't Look Now.
Uh-huh.
The Italian one, it was called In Venice, A Shocking Red December.
Oh, wow.
But in Germany, it was called Wenn die Golden Trauer tragen, which translates to When the Gondolas Wear Grief. So I think that might be the title you're looking for.
That is it.
When the Gondolas Wear Grief.
So the blind sister says that she sensed his psychic abilities, though latent they may be. He says he never experienced anything like a psychic vision before, but the sister says that it could be that you just never noticed.
And even they think that his son's illness was what the warnings from Christine were all about.
Yeah.
My sister felt you had psychic understanding, she told your wife. She also told your wife last night in the restaurant that you were to experience trouble and you should leave Venice. Well, don't you believe now that the telegram was proof of this? Your son was ill, possibly dangerously, and so it was necessary for you to return home immediately.
So he asks why he saw them in the boat. She answers, thought transference, perhaps. Your wife may have been thinking about us. We gave her our address. Should you wish to get in touch with us, we shall be here another 10 days. And she knows that we would pass on any message that my sister might have from your little one in the spirit world.
So kind of underplaying that you saw the future thing, which the blind sister had said earlier.
Yeah. He says here it's kind of weirds him out a bit like that because he had a sudden, rather unkind picture of the two sisters putting on headphones in their bedroom, listening to the coded message from poor Christine. He gets their addresses in Edinburgh from them, and he goes on to say goodbye, but the blind sister, she starts to go into a trance. She says, the child! I can see the child!
And then to his dismay, a bead of froth appeared at the corner of her mouth. Her head jerked back, and she half collapsed in her sister's arms. So we do get that little bit of a trance state in the story.
The other sister tells him that she can manage her sister on her own. She gets sick after these trances sometimes, so she apologizes again and then leaves.
Poor old girls first dragged to police headquarters and put through an interrogation and then a psychic fit on top of it all. More likely epilepsy. I would probably think the same thing.
Yeah. As he walks out, he notices that he doesn't really know where he is. As he tries to make his way back to his hotel, he sees the little girl in the hood again. She's running away from a man, and he thinks this man might be the murderer or some drunken family member who's going to go beat a kid. He hears her make not a sob, but like a panic-laden cry, and he follows her into a courtyard, and he tells the little girl that he won't hurt her, and the child runs on, and he follows her up some stairs. It leads to a small room with a battered old bed and a pile of rags on the floor. And he holds out his hand to her, saying, "It's all right. It's all right."
The child struggled to her feet and stood before him, the pixie hood falling from her head onto the floor. He stared at her, incredulity turning to horror, to fear. It was not a child at all, but a little, thick-set woman dwarf, about 3 feet high, with a great, square, adult head, too big for her body. Grey locks hanging shoulder length. And she wasn't sobbing anymore. She was grinning at him, nodding her head up and down. Then he heard the footsteps on the landing outside, and the hammering on the door, and a barking dog, and not one voice, but several voices shouting, "Open up, police!" The creature fumbled in her sleeve, drawing a knife, and as she threw it at him, with hideous strength, piercing his throat, he stumbled and fell, the sticky mess covering his protecting hands. And he saw the Vaporetto with Laura and the two sisters streaming down the Grand Canal. Not today, not tomorrow, but the day after that. And he knew why they were together and for what sad purpose they had come. The creature was gibbering in its corner. The hammering and the voices and the barking dog grew fainter. And, oh God, he thought, what a bloody silly way to die.
Whoa!
And that's the end.
That is the end.
There's a knife-throwing dwarf serial killer stalking Venice that we've just seen here at the very, very end of this story. And it's kind of a trick ending. He had a psychic vision,
yeah,
but it was the one of his own funeral. The little girl running around, we were tricked into thinking maybe he was seeing Christine, but in fact, it was this dwarf.
Yes.
I felt a little confused because never in a million years would I have thought that this was a murderous dwarf instead of his daughter.
Yeah, dude, when I was watching the movie, I couldn't believe it. Like, I'm like, what just happened? I don't understand. This is crazy. And then I read the story and it ended the same way. And I'm like, I love it because it totally surprised me. It was different enough that I didn't know what was coming. I don't know how I could have known what was coming, but that was fun.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It was definitely a WTF ending. I thought there's no way this happens in the story exactly this way. This movie must have clumsily structured itself or something and then boom, it was exactly the same.
Yeah.
Except in the movie, she sort of cuts his throat.
Yeah.
She gets close and does it versus this, which is kind of a ninja move, you know?
And in the movie as well, they have Christine in a red slicker when she drowns.
Yes.
Like a red raincoat. And then the dwarf girl is also in a red coat.
Right.
So it totally looks like he's having a vision. So that's a little bit more tricky, you know, a little bit too much of a coincidence. But then there was also some weird stuff in the movie where, like, in the photo of the church that he was looking at, because he was doing renovations there,
mm-hmm,
it looked like she was in the photo.
Yeah.
Do you remember that? And then when the water spilled on it, like, it ran across, and there was, so all this very strange, surreal stuff was going on in the movie that doesn't come across in the story, obviously.
Yeah.
Honestly, that movie I thought was one of the weirdest movies I'd ever seen.
Absolutely. I mean, it is kind of a terrifying film.
Yeah.
It was hard to get through at parts, but it was totally worth it because when it was scary, it was really scary. And this thing that she pulls off here, Du Maurier, it's a little anti-story in a way. We're so habituated to having clues laid for us.
Mm-hmm.
She just involves herself intimately with this couple. And when somebody is randomly murdered by somebody else, it is just that. It's a random thing.
Yeah.
The person meets them at the same moment as the murder. And so you won't have clues about it intertwined through your life. It's just something that happens suddenly and awfully.
Yeah.
And so in a way, it's totally appropriate that this happens this way.
Yeah.
Without the normal threading of, you know, you would think he would have seen visions of this woman, or there would have been some indication, you know, I don't know. He would have seen not just the future of his funeral, but maybe of this, of a knife or of something that would have, you know, go, I'm going to be a victim of this murder. But no, it's just not given to you.
No.
Everything involves their dead daughter. So pretty interesting stuff. Also, the psychics aren't very traditional in terms of psychics in media, whether they're hucksters or have real ability. There's no seance.
Uh-huh.
They put a little seance scene in the movie, but even that wasn't typical.
Right.
They don't seem to be doing this for profit.
No.
They don't seem to really be even asking people to come get this advice from them.
No.
They just happen to be in the restaurant at the same time as John and Laura. It's a really cool story.
It's a very cool story and very well written. I thought this book goes fast.
Yeah.
When I was reading it.
It's very human. You know, we don't have some sort of dispassionate occult investigator looking at the facts and trying to create some solution. You just have a couple who are very normal.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously they've got a little bit of wealth, but also, you know, they don't exactly, because they're worried about the money they spent on this trip at one point. So they have some economic anxiety as well. They just seem very like typical people you might know,
Yeah.
And the biggest concern is what happened. I saw my wife, but I think she's in England or she should be. And it's just a very, it could be a very commonplace screw up that you would occupy your time being worried about.
Oh my God. Yeah. I would be freaking.
And so they spend so much time in that emotional place that when this other stuff comes in, it just, it's really cool, man. It affects the characters in different ways than you would expect. And
yeah,
I'm happy with it. I am.
Me too.
Good choice.
That's it for our Weird Women of August.
Of August, but we're probably going to do this month again and fairly soon because we have so many stories to draw from.
We have so many. People have been just shooting us all these very cool sounding stories with lots of great female authors. I'm excited to jump into them. I think we're going to do another C.L. Moore. There's a C.L. Moore story that folks have been really clamoring for. So I think we're going to have to deliver that one. Where the next episode is going to be another Patton show.
That's right. We're going to do a third Michael Shea story. This one is called Copping Squid, what the collection is named after.
Mm-hmm.
Patton's on that one, and it's going to be a fun discussion. And then there'll probably be a couple months, but he'll be appearing. We're going to do a lot of Shea stories with him, so it should be a recurring thing we do on the show. And this is the next one, so I hope you guys all enjoy that. And then after Patton's show, I have no idea what we're doing for the rest of the month, but probably drawing from your excellent suggestions. We love getting feedback from you guys, and we have a huge document full of all kinds of stories we'll probably tackle at some point in the future. Right now, I would like to thank the folks who are keeping this show going by contributing on Patreon. There are a lot of them.
Yeah.
Here are 10 in specific that I'm particularly into this week.
Yeah, me too.
I want to thank Jarrett Toe.
A Mark Priest.
Andrew Zaffron.
Jason Murray.
Timothy Cottrell.
Bradley Gordon.
Miles Lewis.
And Matthew.
The Mythology Translated Podcast.
Josh Whitaker.
And Dr. Pandaman.
Dr. Pandaman. He finally got his PhD.
He finally did. It's not Mr. Pandaman anymore. This is a doctor you're talking to.
So thank you all for supporting us. If it wasn't for you, this show wouldn't be going on.
Half panda, half man, all urologist. We'll be back next week. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At hppodcraft.com.
hppodcraft.com.